What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 11, Quidditch.
Ooh. Excellent intro today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really, really top shelf.
Yeah, really. I really tried to hone in on my introduction, my host voice.
No, it was good. Yeah, I could tell. Yeah, you've been working on it, clearly.
Right, yes. Clearly. Beth, last night I've been reading Harry Potter to my son, Luke, and like I came downstairs and she was like, I just wanted to tell you, I heard you doing like McGonagall's voice and I was like really impressed. Like you sounded really good. And I was like, well, thank you.
Wow.
McGonagall?
That is high praise.
I know. I was like, you almost went out of your way to tell me that. So thank you so much. And now I'll see if I can summon it the next time McGonagall has a line in the book, because I realized I just set myself up for total failure.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
This, like, this wait is, a minute.
It's like night, night.
Hold on.
Would you like to demonstrate for us? Or yeah, no pressure. Are you sweating all
just
the time,
know or? That my wife is impressed with me.
Yeah, there we go. There
yeah,
we go.
My I wife mean, thinks I'm cool.
There you go. That's a good t-shirt. That's a good t-shirt.
Yeah.
No, that being said, chapter 11, the chapter that is Quidditch.
Quidditch.
I personally find to be a spectacular chapter.
Oh.
It does a really splendid job of both progressing. Well, let me back that up. I would say it does a really splendid job of telling a Quidditch match, making it fun and engaging for us, the reader, while also progressing the plot.
It does.
So
yeah,
I think that's the proper order to deliver that in.
Yeah, and the chapter, sort of like last week, the chapter is broken up into two sections. Basically, the front half is Snape takes Harry's Quidditch book and Harry tries to get it back, and then we just have the Quidditch match.
Yeah, so this chapter in particular, I think, is the other thing I would say about it is that it is slightly heavy-handed to the tune of, like, it had never really occurred to me until we read it through, like, in this way before, because normally, I mean, if you just read, you can finish this book in usually like 4 hours or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I mean, if you really wanted to, this is an easy book to finish in one day. So yeah, the fact that we're taking 17 weeks to do it, you know, no big deal.
Yeah, no. So, but I would say the thing that I've noticed is that, like, up until this point, we know that, like, Snape clearly doesn't like Harry. He's clearly kind of like, you know, like needled him a couple of times. First day of class, there's like the moment with like the scar hurting, you know, that type of thing. But
yeah.
For the most part, up until this point, though, we haven't had lots of other super major incidents where we're like kind of led to believe that Snape is like that nefarious. Like, maybe he doesn't like Harry, but this is the chapter that sort of like point your suspicion at Snape.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they definitely really try and paint Snape as the bad guy. Like, last chapter, he, like, you know, was headed towards the third floor corridor, and it's like, oh, and then maybe he was limping a little bit, but what is that enough to, like, cast suspicion on him or anything. Maybe just a little, but now it's getting, yeah, very like, look at Snape, look at Snape.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So this feels like the chapter where like the sleight of hand is really occurring. And I would say not even so sleight of hand. It's sort of like Harry at this point in time is actively being interfered with. And even the fact that the chapter leads with like this little segment of Harry being out on the grounds and, you know, like reading from, you know, Quidditch through the ages and losing 5 points from Gryffindor. And then like, you know, Harry being like, well, I'm going to go try to get my book back and discovering Snape receiving bandages from Filch of all people.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll get back to that part. Cause that was so stupid. Like, especially like this many parts about this chapter I feel like did not age well as like maybe more of the world became established.
Yeah. I think that's a fair way to put it. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. Anyway, well, let's do our normal thing. We can kind of skate through the chapter as we go.
Yeah.
Pick out all the stuff that kind of stands out to us and analyze as we do. So
we will. So I mean, first paragraph, Ben, Hagrid could be seen from the upstairs windows defrosting broomsticks on the Quidditch field.
if you're
nothing about this sentence to me makes sense. One, it sounds like Hagrid's doing magic, which he should not be allowed to do. Two, why are there broomsticks just left willy-nilly on the Quidditch field? Three, even if that's the case, why aren't you just bringing them inside? Like, not what is going on?
Yeah, why would this goes back to our question from last week where we talked about like the up thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's almost like is there some type of ceremony attached to the game of Quidditch wherein the night before all players go and like drop their broomsticks in the place that they intend to, you know, like take off from or something like that? Like, why would they be all left outside?
Yeah, no, I have no idea. To me, it just sounds like out on the Quidditch field, there's a rack of brooms that students can come just grab or something.
Maybe they're just like the school brooms.
But even then, like even later on, I think even in this book, there's like a section where it's like there's a broom shed.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, is I mean the other thing is that like broomsticks are made of wood,
right?
And like the idea of leaving anything wood related. So this is the thing like people maybe don't understand about wood in general is that like wood doesn't rot simply from water exposure. It rots when it's exposed to water and then dry temperatures and then water and then dry temperatures over and over and over again. But if you sink a log underwater, it doesn't decay. It's like this is how you get like petrified wood.
Right,
is from wood just sustaining underwater.
Also, presumably, all of these broomsticks are like very intentionally made as broomsticks for flight and have some amount of like impervious charms on them.
Yes.
So that they would not be subject to the elements. You know, magic is at play, people.
Right, right.
Hagrid.
I'm curious, and I can't remember if this is a characteristic of the Firebolt or not, but maybe it's got like an anti-icing spell on it.
I think so, for like high altitudes.
For high altitudes, yeah. I believe it. I think it does, but I would have to fact check myself on that one. It also brought about, I just because I was thinking about the, because I highlighted the exact same sentence, because I was thinking about broomsticks, it reminded me of a video we made once upon a time that was whether or not broomsticks have cores in the same way that wands do.
Yeah.
And I believe the conclusion that we came down to is they almost certainly need to have a core inside of them, unless the enchantment is just something else entirely. But it feels like you're kind of channeling your magic through the broomstick a little bit, I think.
Right, like otherwise
it's just a piece of wood.
But like, I mean, but like then there's the up thing though. It's like Harry says they're more like horses or something.
That's a good point.
Yeah, they can like sense fear, which does sound like wands. Like wands have a certain like intelligence or sentience about them.
Yeah.
So that kind of sounds like it. So it was, yeah, that sounds pretty plausible to me that they would have some kind of core. Because otherwise, like, is it just that wizards could pick up any stick with bristles on it and fly?
That's the question, because I mean, in like what we know, and I think what Ollivander tells us is that in Deathly Hallows, rather, I think is that like technically a witch or wizard could channel their magic through any object.
Yeah,
but like wands in particular are that much more capable of doing it and establish like an ongoing relationship with the wizard themselves. But to me, what that says, you know, like if James Potter's wand again is made of mahogany and it's just a stick of mahogany, then it's just a stick. It doesn't have like the otherwise infused magical property that comes from the wand core.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it takes both to sort of like determine it as like a magical object. And so in my mind, the logic stands to reason with a broomstick. It's the same way. Like, you know, I mean, you could go and pick up any, you know, like broom from like a muggle broom, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah. You could know? They just pick up any muggle broom and fly on it?
It seems like on some level, like you maybe could, it would be highly inefficient, or like maybe like it couldn't even get you like physically off the ground, but like maybe you could channel like a little bit of lift.
Right.
And,
sure.
Like, through it or something.
You
like
could
that.
Like hover or something.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, not that it really matters one way or another, but I like to think that, yeah, that there's cores tucked inside of the broomsticks.
I like that headcanon as well. Just moving just a little bit down the page, there it mentions Harry's nervous about the upcoming match, and it says, if Gryffindor won, they would move up into second place in the House Championship, which is like an interesting sentence to me because... So they're against Slytherin, and if they beat Slytherin, they'll move up into second behind who? Because like it is established that Slytherin is typically like at the end of the year, Slytherin has the most points.
Yeah.
They've won the cup the last 7 years in a row. So it's like presumably if they beat Slytherin, they'll move into second place behind Slytherin. I guess it's possible Hufflepuff or Ravenclaw is in first at this point.
I suppose that is possible. It's still early in the year. I mean, we're just inside of November, I think, at this point in time.
But either way, it doesn't... It also is curious because later on, like, the specific amounts that you win by, like, matter more to the House Championship. So it's like, if we win, no matter what, we'll move up into second. Whereas if we lose, we won't. Because it sounds like if you, like, later on, there's, like, this whole chapter where it's like, we need to be winning by 50 points. But then this is in relation to the House Championship. So it's like, do you get as many points for the House as you score in the game?
That's the thing, yeah, is that it seems like that would weight the House Cup drastically towards whichever team had the best Quidditch or whichever house had the best Quidditch team, because you know, even at the end of the book, I think that like, you know, Slytherin has approximately 600 points, which is like what Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Neville are able to like overcome and take over with the win. But like if you win three Quidditch matches, that alone, just by catching the snitch, is 450 points.
Right. Which, so that doesn't feel right.
That doesn't feel right.
I guess,
right,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. Here's what must be happening.
Okay.
Is that either at this point, Hufflepuff or Ravenclaw, I guess even Slytherin could be winning. It doesn't matter. That Gryffindor is presently in third place at the moment.
In the House Championship.
In the House Championship. And that by winning a Quidditch match, you earn a set number of points that is unrelated to how many points you actually score.
On the pitch.
On the pitch.
Okay.
For the House Championship. Whereas then the Quidditch Cup matters how many points you actually scored in the game.
But I think that that's more of like a tiebreaker type of situation. Which,
okay,
like with only 14
sure
seems plausible.
Yeah, there's only six matches all year.
Right, yeah. So it seems like...
So maybe it's like if Gryffindor wins, Gryffindor House will just get 50 points for having won.
For having won, okay. Yeah,
something like that.
We don't know that for a verified fact, but that, to me, that seems like the best interpretation of the information we have.
A set number that will move them into second place, so they're losing by whatever the difference is.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Okay.
All right. We figured that out, I think. Let's see. Next up, Harry has Quidditch Through the Ages, which, fun fact, is another, like, you can actually buy Quidditch Through the Ages. I think we had a copy of it when we were kids.
We did, yeah. So back in, like, the way, way, way back when version, there was both a copy. There were these, like, little, like, leaflet-looking books. They were kind of small. But we had both the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them by Newt Scamander. And then we also had Quidditch Through the Ages, which is written by, I thought it was in the book here somewhere. Anyway, but I can't remember exactly who it is offhand. But we did have both of these books as kids, and it was kind of fun and interesting just to, like, leaf through it. And obviously now in the present day, there's like much more bona fide versions of both.
Yes,
of
there are.
Books.
But I remember thinking that, like, even as kids, that, like, when we got these sort of like leaflet versions of the books, because like Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is one of Harry's textbooks, and it was always like Hermione read all of their textbooks cover to cover, and I was like, oh my gosh, what? Like, I don't think I ever read every page of a textbook I owned, ever. But then it was like, oh, wizard textbooks are like 30 pages long, and they're like on paperback, like, oh, well, okay. Hermione's not seeming so impressive all of a sudden.
Right, yeah. Yeah. If anything, the other students is like, guys, they're like 30 pages.
Yeah, you're like, guys, come on. You could knock out like the entire course, the entire first year's worth of textbooks in like an afternoon if you really tried.
Right, yeah. Just crack those books open a little
bit. Crack them in, guys.
Either way, I did underline the 700 ways of committing a Quidditch foul.
Yeah.
Just because I thought that was a fun fact. Oh, on Quidditch Through the Ages, this was my original thought. I remember when Fantastic Beasts was announced as as a film series.
Yeah.
Is I was like, oh, does that mean that like the next one will be Quidditch Through the Ages? Like for whatever reason, that is like the only thing that made sense to me is that like...
Because those two books came out together and one of them's now a movie. And how great would it be to have like a Wizarding World sports movie?
That would be really cool.
Yeah.
I would be all in for like the ultimate underdog story.
I know.
Of like the... Yeah. Like, I mean, I've been watching Welcome to Wrexham,
yeah.
You know, about like sort of like League 5, like, you know... like Welsh football,
right? Sure.
You know, English football, where they're like a sub league, the Champions League, I think is what it's called. And you know, like they're trying to like get promoted and work their way up the, you know, the ladder and stuff like that. So yeah, I'd be all for Quidditch Through the Ages.
Yeah.
Like film series.
I know. Like you don't even need it to be like some crazy dark wizard, big world threatening problem or anything. Just like,
it's just
a sports epic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just about, it's like Miracle on Ice, but brooms in hail. Or something.
Yeah, I love it. Or we can just call it Quidditch Through the Ages.
Quidditch Through the Ages. Yeah.
Okay. I love it. I love it. Yeah, we get the reference in Quidditch Through the Ages that, let's see here. Most serious Quidditch accidents seem to happen to seekers in particular, which I feel like they really like harken on.
Yeah.
Which, as we know, as Harry goes through his years of playing Quidditch, he certainly does sustain some injuries, but they don't always really seem Quidditch related necessarily. He just gets harmed. I mean, even in this very chapter, like someone is actively trying to buck him off of his broom.
Yeah, like he rarely gets injured in Quidditch because of the game. It's like because of interference.
Because
Dementor show up or because the Bludger is literally cursed to hunt him.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yep. But then we get the, let's see here. People rarely died playing Quidditch. Referees had been known to vanish and turn up months later in the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
You know, like what I think is interesting is like they didn't say there was an instance where a referee showed up years later or months later in the Sahara Desert. It's just like when they vanish, they go to the Sahara Desert.
It's like it's happened on multiple occasions. Referees have disappeared and shown up at the Sahara Desert. We don't know how it happens.
We don't know how it happens.
Yeah. That to me reads like whoever was making them disappear was the same culprit over and over.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Not just like Sahara Desert spell. Get out of here, ref.
Okay.
And he's gone.
And why not?
Yep.
Then we get our first glimpse of Hermione's like bright bluebell flame, which I feel like she uses I think on numerous occasions throughout the saga.
Yeah, she absolutely does. Yeah, it's still like one of her little signature spells here. It is baffling to me that like they just have a little fire outside. One, that if it's so cold that they are outside, why not just go inside? Like they're just standing. They're not even standing talking. They're all standing not facing each other with their backs to the fire. But then there also says like they were sure it wouldn't be allowed. And I'm like, why would it not be allowed at a school of magic to have a little magic fire?
Well, I mean, you're not supposed to do magic in the corridors. We know that from like the very beginning. So,
I guess.
I mean, this is outside, but this is like one of those things where it's like, yeah, it really does seem like using magic almost just about anywhere is pretty much forbidden.
Yeah, like excuse me, unless you are learning how to do the magic, don't do it.
Yeah, either in the comfort of your own homes as a trained adult or in class, but that's it.
That's it.
Which I know sounds ridiculous, but that's also probably like driving a car. It's like you can either do it while you're training specifically, or like as a licensed adult, a licensed adult.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to be fair, I guess that actually does track. Either which way. Yeah. So they're not supposed to have it, which I guess demonstrates just a little bit that Hermione is like kind of a bit more open to bending the rules.
I guess so. Yeah. It does say that too, that she was, Hermione had become a bit more relaxed about breaking rules since Harry and Ron had saved her from the mountain troll, and she was much nicer for it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
After that, though, we do get the discovery that like Snape is specifically limping, and they're kind of like, oh, I wonder what's going on with that, which then obviously promptly comes up like 2.5 paragraphs later, where Harry's back up in the Gryffindor common room, and he's just like, man, I really just want to like distract myself with some good old fashioned Quidditch Through the Ages.
Yeah, I know. It's just, this whole thing seems contrived. It's like Harry was outside and Snape came and took his book. Harry wanted his book back, so he came and discovered Snape.
Contrived is the right word.
Yes.
Yeah. It's set up specifically just so that Harry has a, like, this feels like the bit that like it's just like, how do I kind of progress this, go like this plot forward a little bit? I've got it.
I know. We need Harry to be really suspicious of Snape. So what if he sees him trying to fix his wounds? And then it's like, yeah, so he... Harry walks in trying to get the book back. God, I love Harry going up to the staff room, knocks, no one's there. And he's like, perhaps Snape had left the book in there. I was like, why? Sure. Okay.
Yeah. I remember there being like a teacher's lounge, you know, going through like elementary school and stuff like that. Like I don't even know if I ever knew where they were, but I feel like the existence of the lounge itself was like, you know. I was like, yeah, that's
some like mythical, magical place.
Right. But the other thing too, to me about Hogwarts in particular is that near as I can tell, all of the professors just simply live in the castle.
Yeah.
And so the idea of them ever going to like the teacher's lounge just seems, maybe it's not that far fetched. Like, you know, you got to go and have a place to have a cup of Job or something.
Yeah, somewhere to microwave your fish lunch.
Okay. All right. Now here's a question. Which Hogwarts professor is microwaving fish lunch?
Oh my gosh. Who is it? That's Trelawney. You know?
Trelawney.
She just like comes down from the tower and is like, hello. Is anyone using the microwave?
It's like,
everyone's like, we don't even have a microwave, Sybil.
Yeah.
Electronics don't work here.
McGonagall is just like I could see McGonagall knowing that there is a microwave in the teacher's lounge and actively hating it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Who put this here?
And I'm not having it. Mm-mm. Anyway, what Harry discovers upon entering the teacher's lounge is that Snape and Filch are in there alone. Mm-hmm. And Snape is holding his robe above his knees and Filch is handing him bandages.
Yeah.
Even the fact that Snape is like openly talking to Filch saying, how are you supposed to keep your eyes on all three heads at once? It's like, I'm like, this doesn't sound like Snape at all. This is the least Snape sentence I've ever heard.
I know. Nothing about this situation to me makes sense. One, that Snape and Filch are hanging out together at all. There you go. It's already weird if Harry just walked in and it was Snape and Filch be like, what do you think about the students today? I hate them again. You do. Like, they're just not hanging out.
We're such best buds.
I know. Two, that specifically what they're doing is changing Snape's bandages in the staff lounge of all places. Like, why aren't they doing this in Snape's office or whatever? Because, like, he's clearly trying not to be seen, and this is a place where any teacher could walk in.
Right. Alternatively, just simply the hospital wing.
I guess you could argue he doesn't want, like, the injury to be discovered by maybe the other teachers or something, and like Madame Pomfrey would know then.
You think in the teacher's lounge is the best place to keep?
That's exactly what I'm saying,
though. It's like, yeah, I mean, I understand where you're coming from, but just, yeah, I don't think.
So there's that. Okay. On top of that, like later, I mean, this is another one of those situations where it's like maybe the world just wasn't as established yet or something. But like later on, when Harry hits Draco with Sectum Sempra, this like dark magic spell that like slices him with a sword, Snape arrives on the scene and is able to heal the spell like instantly. And this is like a dark magic spell, like at once with his wand is able to like save Draco's life. This is, Snape is suffering a dog bite apparently for several days and hasn't been able to heal it like himself magically. Like
Snape did invent Sectum Sempra, so maybe he knows the counter curse.
I suppose you could argue that he knows the counter curse, but like Snape seems like a good enough wizard that he could heal a simple like bite wound.
He is who Dumbledore goes to even after the he puts on the Horcrux.
Yeah, he
ring.
Knows how to do that. Yeah. He knows how to solve that. So there's that. All I can surmise from this is that Fluffy's like bite contains some sort of like absolutely horrendous venom in it.
Ooh,
you know,
kind of like basilisky.
Exactly, like basilisky or like Nagini or something. Because Weasley gets bit by Nagini, and it's like, yeah, he's like injured for a while until they can finally figure out how to heal it back up.
And that's healers at St. Mungo's, people whose actual career is like specifically doing that. Yeah. Okay, I like that.
So that is my new. That's the only thing that makes sense to me is that if Fluffy bites you, it is like more than it is like a cursed bite of
it's like
of
a bad
sorts.
Bite. Yeah, I bet Newt could do it. Newt's commander.
Well, of course, Newt could do it. Classic. Okay, Newt's the man.
But he's in retirement, so. Anyway, so Snape obviously gets extremely mad at Harry for being there, for witnessing this particular thing. But like, that's the other thing that's happening inside of this chapter is that we're really starting to, I mean, because we don't even have that much book left. The Golden Trio needs enough information to start tugging on the strings that will start to pull it all together. So. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry. The last thing I feel like that doesn't make sense about Snape's bite is like, why was he trying? Like, okay, so because Harry says he tried to get past a three-headed dog at Halloween. That's where he was going when we saw him. And it's like, that's true. That is where he was going. But in like, why was Snape facing Fluffy? You know, like, what was he doing in there? Like, why was he in a situation to get, like, bitten at all? Like, because we know Quirrell didn't get past Fluffy. It wasn't like Snape was like, oh, man, I got to follow Quirrell down the trap door and get past this dog, too.
Well, you don't think, you know, I mean, my interpretation as you asked the question is that Quirrell did get past Fluffy.
No, we know he didn't because Hagrid hasn't let slip about the music yet.
The music.
Yeah.
You're right.
So, so Quirrell doesn't know how to get past Fluffy. So clearly, like, he's there to cut Quirrell off, but does he just like go past the door and like wait for him or something?
Yeah,
like why not wait outside the door?
There's not a particularly good reason why Snape would have to face Fluffy in this particular instance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good point. The other kind of irony here is that he is struggling with a multi-faced foe.
Yeah.
Which Quirrell is also a multi-faced foe.
Oh, that's true. That's funny. Yep. Yeah.
So kind of like, I mean, the specific thing is, how are you supposed to keep your eyes on all three heads at once? It's like, I don't even know. I've never caught that before. But like, I almost wonder if that's supposed to be like a little nod, like more than one face.
Yeah. Be on the lookout.
Okay. Like it.
Also, like Harry says, I bet my broomstick he let that troll in. I'm just like, you'd have lost that bet, sir. Hand over that broomstick.
I know. Although he's pretty close to the correct assessment.
He is.
Someone let in the troll to make a diversion. It wasn't Snape in particular. So then anyway, Harry starts to kind of like do the thing that Harry sometimes does, which is almost setting aside, you know, his daily high school existence in exchange for starting to wonder about like the bigger picture.
Yeah.
You know, like what else is going on? Because, you know, he's basically struggling with his nerves about Quidditch and essentially ends up like being distracted, saying Harry went to bed with his head buzzing with the same question, which is what's he after and what's that dog guarding? So this is just like another one of those sort of like innate inside of Harry situations where it's just sort of like, you know, like the, like as much as he might love Quidditch, it's like the thing that can distract him from Quidditch is justice.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's like, I got to figure out what Snape is up to.
Yep. Yep. What is going on? So anyway, the next morning kicks off and we know that Harry is kind of having a very similar morning to what Ron's first Quidditch match looks like.
Same as Ron later on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like when Ron is eventually, is it in year five? Yeah, it must be year five.
Yeah.
That Ron's really nervous about Quidditch. It seems like they almost have, I'd be curious to compare the passages because I think that they are like darn near the same, or at least the sentiment is very much the same. One of the things I noticed as we scroll down here is specifically we get a line from Seamus that says, Harry, you need your strength. Seekers are always the ones who get clobbered by the other team. And then literally the next paragraph, we get a line about Dean that says, Ron and Hermione join Neville, Seamus, and Dean, the West Ham fan, up in the top row.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like interesting because I feel like Dean does ultimately become like a bigger part of the story. But like it almost feels like at this point in time, like the fact that like we're being reminded like, oh, do you remember Dean? He's the one who is
the likes West Ham fan. That's like his defining characteristic.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I tend to think of like, and maybe this is like Parvati and Lavender sort of like are like a couplet.
Yeah.
You know, Seamus and Dean seem like they sort of like are always representing kind of similar like space inside of like the
Gryffindor Tower.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I thought that was kind of interesting. We also get, maybe we're not there yet. So I'll save my next thought there.
It says the whole school seemed to be out in the stands. I always think it's funny that whenever there's a Quidditch match that Harry's playing in, it's like the whole school was there. But like at zero point ever is it like, you know, do you hear about Harry, Ron, and Hermione going to watch the Hufflepuff Ravenclaw match?
I know.
You know, like they you never hear about them attending non-Gryffindor matches.
It's so true. Yeah, it's like there's literally no instances, I feel like, ever where we get almost anything other than like a score recap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, flattened by Hufflepuff in that last match.
As we move forward, though, we get the speech from Oliver Wood.
Yes, I totally marked down the exact same thing. It's a good speech.
great speech. It's what does he even end up saying? Like, okay, men and women, this is it, the big one, the one we've been waiting for. And then
Fred and George like basically immediately interrupt him.
Fred says, we know Oliver's speech by heart, we were on the team last year. This is one of the things I wrote a little note down about, because I'm pretty sure Charlie was supposed to be at school last year and was Seeker, which means that Oliver possibly was like a underclassman captain of Charlie Weasley, like renowned Quidditch seeker.
I think it's been like 2 years since Charlie was there.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we worked that out.
Okay.
At one point. But like, yeah, you're right. Like it says, well, we memorized his speech, and it's like the speech is this. Had they not been interrupted, the entire speech would have been this. Okay, men, this is the big one. The one we've all been waiting for. This is the best team Gryffindor's had in years. We're going to win. I know it. That would have been the whole speech. Like, no wonder you memorized it. It was one line.
Yeah, there's not a lot to say there.
That's not, like, it's not a speech. And it's like, to me, I was like, Oliver, be original, man. You're using the same one sentence speech every game. Come on.
Right. Maybe you need to work some a little more gusto into firing up your team there before the big game.
I know.
That was the other one that I said is basically this is the best team Gryffindor's had in years. We're gonna win it. And it seems like it was just about the same team. I did write down Harry instead of Charlie, so maybe if Charlie had been 2 years out, that would make sense. But we do also learn that Alicia Spinett was a last year reserve. Yeah. So,
I noticed that too because I was like, there's no reserves on the team right now,
right?
And it's interesting that it seems like the whoever was the seeker last year must have been a seventh year because it's not like, oh, it's that you don't find out otherwise who it was.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I wrote down at the end of the chapter as well was just that, like, we know that Malfoy takes over as Slytherin seeker in year two, which could mean that during Harry's first ever Quidditch match as a first year, he was going up against the seventh year.
Oh, it could mean that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also would not surprise me if Lucius was just like, I don't care if there's a seeker already, get him off the team.
That's why I say, I feel like it's like, it's conceivable or it's just the Malfoys just throwing their weight around for always because they might do that. On the note of what year everybody is, there's just another one of those like little changes that has been made in the reprints since the original recording. Cause I both read and listened to the chapter. Marcus Flint in the audiobook is referred to as a sixth year. However, in the book, he's a fifth year. I think the thing about this is that Marcus Flint is still the Slytherin captain all the way up to Harry's third year. And if he was a sixth year, that would make him an eighth year.
Yeah, he failed out, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Had to redo a year.
Yeah. Just kind of sticking around.
So I love Lee Jordan's commentary of the Quidditch matches. That's always one of my favorite things.
Oh, same here. Yep. I wrote that down as well.
Yep. I thought this is very interesting, not even super interesting, but like he says, and the Quaffle is taken immediately by Angelina Johnson to Gryffindor. What an excellent chaser that girl is, and rather attractive too, which I love that. It's like, clearly, it's like, it makes it sound like Lee has like a little bit of a crush on Angelina, which is totally great. But I think it's funny though that he doesn't ask her to the Yule Ball later on.
That's so true.
You know, like, I mean, and there's time, like Fred basically forgets to do it for a while.
Yeah, and he just sort of like, hey, you want to go? And she's like, I'm in.
I guess so. And I'm like, Lee, where were you, dude?
Come on, man. Come on.
That was your chance.
I know.
Oh, well.
No, I do love Lee Jordan. This was another one that I felt like when Dad was reading us the books when we were a little kid. I feel like Dad had fun with like the Lee Jordan commentary. But there's like so many like good moments, and I love the fact that McGonagall is like literally standing there over his shoulder, and I can just imagine hearing McGonagall's voice sort of like distantly echoing through the stadium as she's like chastising him for everything he keeps saying.
She's used to this by now.
Yes, she's like, I know what I'm gonna have to do. Mm-hmm. Then we get the let's see here, what do they say about Fred and George Weasley? But he's blocked by a second bludger sent this way by Fred or George Weasley, can't tell which. Nice play by the Gryffindor beater anyway.
Yeah.
It's all such good stuff.
And it's like their best friend too.
I know.
Like,
yeah,
whoever.
Yeah, which is always one of those things that like, because you're watching this through the lens of like Team Gryffindor, it's always like you sort of love that Lee Jordan is the commentator, but like if it was like a Slytherin commentator, it would be like the worst.
Yeah,
you know, I'd be like, what? No.
Oh, what do you mean you can't tell which one?
Somebody needs to put a stop to this. You know, it's ridiculous.
No good. Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pair Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pair Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped because I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think honestly kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to paireyewear.com and use code Griffin for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's paireyewear.com, code Griffin.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Anyway, then we scroll down a little bit and we get a change in perspective. This was actually, I got halfway through this thought earlier and I changed gears, where we're actually watching the plot unfold from Hermione, Ron, and Hagrid's like version of things,
yeah,
through the stands. So it's like one of those rare instances where like you're not seeing it through Harry's perspective,
right?
But then what Hagrid says is, "Been watching from me hut, been watching from my hut," said Hagrid, patting a large pair of binoculars around his neck. "But it isn't the same as being in the crowd. No sign of the Snitch yet, eh?" And this is like one of those things where like the game just started. So does he mean like he's been watching Quidditch from his hut, like in years past, or like since 30 seconds ago when the game started, he managed to like watch some of the game from his hut,
yeah,
where he then blitzed his way.
Like, what have you been watching? Only, yeah, like one thing has happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's so, like, yeah, if you've been watching from your hut, then you watched them catch the Quaffle and then started walking, at which point presumably you weren't watching because it's, like, I even wrote that. It said, "Been watching from your hut." I wrote, "How?"
Yeah, I said, I said, like, before today?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Like, whatever. Hagrid's in the stands. That's the point. No need to justify his existence there, I don't think.
Yeah, no, whatsoever.
Yeah, although scrolling down, I just thought this was like an interesting thing was Harry thinks he sees the golden snitch, but he says once he caught a flash of gold, but it was just a reflection from one of the Weasleys' wristwatches. And I was like, well, it is interesting to me that the Weasleys, who are apparently super poor, one of them owns a gold wristwatch and is wearing it during a sports match.
A sports match. Yeah. You know? I mean,
during a sports ball.
Who doesn't wear their favorite Rolex during a sports play?
Like, you're wearing a metal watch in the middle of a game? That seems like,
it actually,
I don't know.
This feels like one of those things, like, they tell you not to wear, like, flashy jewelry while snorkeling and stuff like that, because it can sometimes, like, signal to, like a barracuda or something that, like, you know, it's like, hey, that's like a shiny fish over there. But it actually feels like wearing a gold watch in particular could be actively distracting in the exact way that it is in this scene.
It does, yeah.
The other thing that's kind of interesting about that, this is totally just nitpicking. I'm not actually upset about this particular detail, but we know that wizards typically are gifted a gold watch once they come of age.
Yeah.
It's like a tradition. So like we see this happen, and the Weasleys are obviously, they have not come of age yet. So, I mean, the fact that they have a gold watch, I mean, you could just have like a gold plated watch. Like, people have gold
for
watches,
sure. Absolutely.
You know I have very inexpensive, or at the very least, Alice has very inexpensive gold watches at our house that are not made of like proper gold.
Right.
They're gold colored.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could have that. It doesn't feel like in the wizarding world they have gold colored things. It's just like, it's gold. Gold is gold.
Gold is gold. You know? Yeah. Oh, one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting is that, again, going back to Lee Jordan's commentating, it says, Chaser Pusey ducks two bludgers, two Weasleys, and Chaser Bell, and speeds toward, wait a moment, was that the snitch? And this is like, it's like, man, why has Lee Jordan not been on the team if he, as the commentator, is spotting the snitch?
I know, yeah.
It's very impressive.
He's all over it. And then I think he says that, and then it says, the Chasers seem to have forgotten what they were supposed to be doing as they hung in midair to watch. It's like, I was just like, guys, that's no excuse. Amateur hour over here.
I know, seriously.
You cannot be distracted by the Seeker seeing the snitch. You got to keep playing. You know, you got to play through that.
Call yourself future professional athletes.
I know, exactly. You know who doesn't get distracted is Marcus Flint later on. He's like, hey, something's happening. Doesn't matter. I'm just going to score 5 goals real quick while no one's looking, which do count.
Yeah. I know. But if nobody's looking, then how does anybody know that he's scoring goals?
Madam Hooch. I was like, as soon as Harry's broom starts bucking, it's like the whole stadium is watching this. And I'm like, what is Madam Hooch doing?
Yeah,
clearly, something is wrong with Harry's broom. And she's like, you know what? He's going to sort that out. I need to make sure I'm keeping an eye on that quaffle. Everyone keeping score. Flint, you got it? Score. And also, like, apparently, is there just no reset between scores, I guess?
I know. I had the same thought. Like, is he just throwing it through the hoop, running to the ground, picking it back up, running in the air, throwing it through the hoop, running to the ground, picking it back up.
Oliver's just sitting there like,
It's like, come on, Oliver, man. Supposed to be the best team we've had in years.
I know.
Yeah.
All these guys just sitting ducks out there.
Yeah. I think in general, the real point is that Harry is never, ever, 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 ever the benefactor of an adult being present.
Yeah.
It feels like always, like, Malfoy will be like picking on him and somehow Snape will come over and punish Harry for it.
Yeah.
Or if McGonagall is present, then it'll be like, she'll only catch it once Harry pulls his wand out.
Yeah.
And be like, Potter, what are you doing?
I know.
It's just like, oh, poor Harry.
I know.
It's just like, gosh, if anybody had been here 10 seconds sooner, you would have seen who's picking on me.
Yeah. Seriously. Madam Hooch. Hagrid of all people, who can't even ride brooms, is sitting there telling Ron and Hermione that, like, no one can interfere with the broomstick unless it's dark magic or whatever. Like, Hagrid knows enough about brooms that something dark is going on. Madam Hooch, the broom expert and flying instructor and referee of this match, does nothing, even though it is super clear, even to Hagrid, that something bad is happening.
That's the thing about this too. It's like, I mean, we said it like at the beginning of the chapter, but it's like the whole school showed up for this particular thing. Like,
yeah.
Like, of all of the occasions to try to attack Harry, it's like you are literally doing it with every available witness.
Except apparently Dumbledore. Because he's going to show up to the next match, and they're all like, oh, good thing Dumbledore will be there. Snape will never try to attack Harry now.
That's a good
point.
Which
kind of implies that Dumbledore is not at this one.
Right. Dumbledore, come on, man.
Yeah.
How do you miss this?
How are you missing this?
Anyway. Yeah. No big deal. But yeah. So anyway, as we go forward, I talked about this a little bit. Like, I think going back to flying lessons, but I think in the movie in particular, they show Neville's broom bucking in a very similar capacity to like what happens to Harry's, which I feel like almost like sets up this idea that like, oh, maybe brooms are just like malfunctioning and like Neville's just not very good at flying a broom. So like, when it's happening to Harry, it's like, you know, it's his first time. Like, maybe he's just struggling up there. But like, that doesn't happen in the book. So yeah, you're right. It does seem like the type of thing that should have stood out in a much more obvious way.
It does seem like that. Thankfully, Hermione is sitting across the stands from the teachers and notices it and decides it is up to her to solve this problem. And I mean, I want to know why Hermione is not running for wizard track, because Hermione is sitting in apparently 50-foot tall stands and sees across the pitch Snape mouthing the counter jinx, or what she believes is the jinx. Yep. And she runs to the ground from five stories up, across the pitch, and then up five flights of stairs.
That's 10 flights of stairs for those keeping track.
And I'm like, and this is like just like an 11-year-old girl. Like, even if she is sprinting, like, apparently she doesn't go across the field either. You know, you got to think she goes around. Like, she's not going to be allowed on the field.
Right. Yeah, most likely. Although Madame Hooch isn't paying attention.
That's true. She's just like, Flint is scoring. And as I think about it, though, the fact that it only scores five, kind of embarrassing. You should be way more than that.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, she apparently makes it all the way over, down, over, back up, lights Snape's robes on fire, and then it takes an additional 30 seconds for him to notice.
The 30 seconds?
30 seconds, yeah.
I feel like if we were to give you a 30-second moment of silence, you would be like blown away. 30 seconds is too long.
It is way too long. Yeah. Now, to be fair, that it should have stopped the moment that she knocks Quirrell over, which That's happens true. Well 30 seconds well before, which means there's like 30 seconds of Snape just continuously undoing the jinx before he notices it. And apparently he finishes doing it and then just happens to be at the same time that he notices that he's on fire.
Yeah. And that's probably a fair point. Yeah. So maybe this is the type of thing where like whatever Quirrell is doing, like you almost imagine like that they're both casting like jinx and counter jinx simultaneously, and like one sort of like it's kind of like a different sort of duel,
yeah,
if you will. But maybe it's the type of thing where like Snape continued to keep his eyes fixed on the ear and was continuing to like basically like unwind whatever Quirrell had already done.
Right.
But again, as you learn more about Snape, it does seem like the type of thing that Snape just would have been able to like absolutely like dismantle. Because one of the things that I will always credit Snape for is I do think he's a super powerful wizard.
Except to healing his leg.
You know, but again, we covered that, you know.
Yeah, it's fluffy.
It's
that fluffy venom.
It's three dog saliva.
Yeah.
It really gets into your bloodstream. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. Let's see here. So then what do we have next?
Then Harry swallows the snitch.
Yeah. Okay. This was the thing that I think stood out to me the most about this entire chapter, actually, was just simply how quickly following Hermione's interference that Harry just like it, like in my mind, I feel like I have repainted the picture that like Harry still patrols and like, you know, him and the Slytherin seeker like duking it out, trying to figure out who can like get to this like the snitch the fastest. But it's basically just like his broom is being jinxed, and then the moment that it's over, he goes into a dive and swallows the snitch.
Yeah, just like on accident. Like, yeah. This is one where maybe the movie did it a little bit better, where they pull out of the dive and Harry is broom surfing like a boss. And then like leans a little too far forward and accidentally swallows it, even though he was about to grab it. This just sounds like he saw it, was like, hey, there it is. Got it. Did we win?
Excellent.
Did we win?
Excellent reenactment. Although that being said, Flint is saying he didn't catch it. He nearly swallowed it as like a counter. It's like, Flint, you can't possibly think it makes a difference.
Yeah. He's holding it in his hand now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this would be like if like a wide receiver in football managed to somehow like, I, in fact, I think this has even been like a thing before where like a quarterback threw the ball and it got stuck in somebody's like face mask.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if it didn't hit the ground, I mean, you know,
still
like
in play.
It's still in play. Yeah.
Still in play.
Yeah. I mean, but he got it in his hands eventually.
Yeah.
And then of course the kind of big thing about the fact that Harry catches it with his mouth ends up being super vital to the discovery of how to get the hidden message from the snitch, from Dumbledore.
You know what's great about this is that Dumbledore uses this snitch as a way to make sure that the ministry is unable to open the snitch and recover the stone inside.
Right.
Even if they go and do Harry in person and let him physically touch it. But you know what? Dumbledore wasn't even at this match to watch it happen.
Somebody told him.
Someone told him. He's like, I have an idea. I know what's going to work. I'm going to put it in my diary
for a rainy day. Yeah. It'll be great.
It's good.
This is going to work out so well because they'll forget the way it played out. And then when they remember, it's going to be like, oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the readers will be like, oh my gosh, I remember that moment.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then they leave the Quidditch pitch where Harry is a hero for the first time, doing a great job. So proud of him. They go to Hagrid's hut where they have a strong cup of tea. And basically you start to kind of get like this first major glimpse at how much the staff seems to back Dumbledore's belief that Snape is in fact trustworthy.
Yeah.
Because we also eventually know that, like, even McGonagall, I think in Deathly Hallows says like Dumbledore always trusted Snape. He said that there was an ironclad reason to do so. Like, which sort of suggests that like the teachers are always like, yeah, we get where you're coming from, but we can't say that out loud.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
like, yeah, we get why you suspect Snape of everything. We do too. But like, we trust Dumbledore and Dumbledore trusts Snape. And if so facto, that's
just getting out to roll with it.
Right. Right. So, you know, for years and years and years, Harry will have this issue with both Snape and Malfoy, where he's just always suspecting them and nobody ever seems to believe him. Which, for the most part,
he's wrong until he's right.
Until he's right. We also get like a bit more of the big information dumps that are going to kind of get us closer towards Harry, Ron, and Hermione starting to like put the pieces of the bigger picture puzzle together, which is learning about Fluffy, the three-headed dog, which of course Hagrid has won off of a Greek chappie he met in the pub, or bought him off of
a Greek chappie.
This is kind of interesting, again, going back to the film just a little bit, because I think in the movie he says it's an Irish chap. Kind of like specifically a Cerberus. Is it the right?
Cerberus.
Cerberus, yeah. He's like a Greek mythological like beast.
Yeah, I mean, Cerberus is like it's not like a breed of dog. I think it's a specific dog that guards like the gates to the underworld for Hades.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, the fact that it's Greek in particular is like a notable like attribute of this.
Yeah, it's part of Greek mythology.
Yeah, but so the fact that like they changed it to Irish in the film is almost like, did you guys miss the reference? Like, it was Greek for a reason.
Yeah, that was the reason to change it.
Anyway, yeah.
Oh, this is also, that's one of those things where sometimes people ask what happens to Fluffy after this story, because it does seem like Fluffy just sort of disappears for no reason.
Yeah.
And Fluffy is sent back to Greece.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's the explanation.
That's the explanation.
That's where Fluffy ends up going. Anyway, so then there's the like trying to steal what? Hagrid clearly knows more than probably is strictly speaking safe.
Yeah.
if you're Dumbledore, and he lets leak the bit of information that what they're guarding is between Professor Dumbledore and Nicholas Flamel.
Mm-hmm. This is one of those where I wish I could read the books for the first time again to see if I would notice that Nicholas Flamel had already been mentioned.
I know.
Like back on the chocolate frog card. Because like, but I, even if you remembered it and flipped back and were like, oh, Nicholas Flamel, look, he's right here. They already talked about it. It just says like alchemy. So you sort of also have to know enough about alchemy to do it. Also, if you're really savvy, it's the title of the book. So maybe you could have pieced it together from that.
Yeah. That's a good point. Like at this point in time, as you're reading the book, you are now like, I would say, let's see, maybe like 70% of the way through the story and nobody has really mentioned whatever this philosopher's or sorcerer's stone.
Yeah.
Is supposed to be.
Right.
So it does feel like, you know, anybody worth their salt should be like, I bet that's what it is.
I bet it's the philosopher's stone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, that's it doesn't, it feels like maybe isn't the title a little spoilery for figuring out what it is? And it's like, nope, turns out it's not.
Right.
Yeah, they just don't mention it. I love how Hagrid reasons, like his reasons for why it can't be Snape. He says, Snape's a Hogwarts teacher. He didn't do nothing of the sort. And it's like, what is interesting is that he is actually correct about Snape, but his reasoning is very incorrect because it is Quirrell and he is a Hogwarts professor and he would do something of the sort.
Right. Yeah. That's like one of those where, but again, I mean, I think this is where Hagrid placed so much trust in Dumbledore where like, you know, Hagrid would just be like, there's no way in the world Dumbledore would ever hire somebody who would do something this wrong.
Right.
Like, and I think that that's just like Hagrid's standing belief. And again, as we go forward, what we'll know is that like Dumbledore does know that Quirrell is not is up to no good.
Yeah.
And this is like where you can start really touching the edges of the concept of Dumbledore's big plan properly, which is that like the first year of Harry's schooling in particular, it largely feels like Dumbledore knows the prophecy. He pretty much knows what Harry's up against. He's always believed that Voldemort will eventually come back and that Harry's entry into the wizarding world is essentially going to be the catalyst that will ultimately probably spark the return of Voldemort. So it pretty much seems like Dumbledore as a betting man, as somebody who like, you know, makes particularly good guesses.
Yeah.
Pretty much knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And like I think even in our version of Dumbledore's big plan, we possibly included the belief that like maybe even the reason that like Hagrid in particular knows such specific details or collects the Philosopher's Stone while he's with Harry, you know, while Harry's like going to collect his school supplies, like it all comes back to the eventual line or belief on Harry's behalf that like Dumbledore basically thought Harry deserved to have a go at it if he so desired.
Right. It's like he wanted him to piece it together. It's like, I can't imagine Dumbledore knew enough to know that Voldemort was living on Quirrell's head. Because like, if Dumbledore knew exactly where Voldemort was, it feels like he just tries to take him out.
It seems that way. I mean, that's a good point. But like, I think that there's something to the tune of like, the neither can live while the other survives. Like, you know, like it, like one of them has to defeat the other effectively. Right. So, I mean, it could be the type of thing where like, you know, Dumbledore's like pretty much when it comes down to it, like it has to be Harry, you know, like
right.
all like what I have to do is prepare Harry. It can't be anybody else. Like I can try to interfere, but the prophecy dictates that I won't
succeed. Yeah,
exactly. So it's like, you know, if Dumbledore's smart enough to put enough faith in the prophecy in this particular way, it's like, it's up to him. It has to be Harry.
He does tell Harry, I think it might be this book, it might be the next one, that there's like, if we can delay him coming back over and over and over and over, maybe he'll never come back or something.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. That might be the diary though. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember for sure or not, but the diary is also the thing that finally tips Dumbledore off to the fact that what Voldemort is using is Horcruxes.
Yes. So yeah.
That's probably a piece where like Dumbledore didn't know how up until this moment Voldemort was achieving immortality.
Right.
How and why he wasn't destroyed in the first place.
So right.
That is a big tipping point in the overall saga in terms of what Dumbledore knows and in the information. So anyway, but I mean, I think it's a fun chapter. It's definitely got like some clunky bits to it, but I do appreciate it's kind of like I think about like the movie Encanto and how every one of the songs that comes about like helps progress the plot so nicely. This feels like a really good situation where like Harry experiencing the wizarding world in this form of playing Quidditch is also like the plot moves forward at the same time.
So yeah.
It's not just like a throwaway chapter where it's like, yeah, Harry plays a sport this chapter.
Right. It's like, it does a good job of establishing like more world building. And like, this is the pacing in the first book is very fun. Like every chapter has something fun happening. It's like, because there's so much to discover, it's like, oh, Harry's dropped off at the Dursleys. Harry releases a snake. Harry is a wizard. Diagon Alley. Gringotts. You know, now we're on the Hogwarts Express. Now we're at Hogwarts. Now, now there's the sorting hat. Now there's a troll. You know, it's like there's like now there's a Quidditch match. You know.
Yes. Yeah. No. I mean, chapter after chapter, there's definitely just like always something going on, which I think is probably what made people, you know, upon reading just this first book alone, just fall so in love with the series because it was just sort of like, well, I want more of that.
Right. Exactly. But that pretty much brings us to the end of chapter 11, Quidditch. Next up, we'll have the Mirror of Erised, a very important chapter indeed. But Ben, what did you think of the chapter art here for chapter 11? We have basically just a couple of Quidditch players swooping around and some balls flying through the air. I guess all four balls.
Yeah, do we have all four? Let's see. I see a bludger. What looks like
there are four balls.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. There we go. Yeah, I think they're all there. No, I love it though. I mean, just Quidditch in general. It's kind of one of those things like Quidditch. Sometimes I feel bad like beating up on it a little bit because it does seem like some of the rules, some of the details of it are just so like silly and quirky and weird. But like at the same rate, it is like one of my favorite parts of like all of the Wizarding World.
Yeah. Like, when we were writing the like what if Harry was in Slytherin script, and whenever we got to a Quidditch match, it was super fun just to write the Quidditch matches.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. It's just sort of like what all goes different now? How does it play out?
Like, yeah, and like how will that matter? How can you use the match to help develop the character?
Right.
Yeah. So that's very fun. Also, I'm kind of looking at the artwork on the quaffle here, and I'm like trying to decide if it's sort of got that weird indented like shape to it that it does in the movies in this picture.
I think it might.
Yeah. It's sort of like, is this because this would sort of be like the very first interpretation of a quaffle, and it does sort of look like it has that like misshapen quality to it. So maybe it's like, is this the source of why the quaffle looks like the quaffle?
You know what I've always found interesting about the quaffle in particular is that it's just so inherently non-magical.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
it's just a regular ball. Well, or a misshapen ball, I guess.
A regular misshapen ball.
Yeah.
The other big question I have, too, is that, like, you know, in this chapter, a couple people take, like, a bludger to the head. It makes you wonder a little bit whether or not, like, there's anything... I was reading just a little bit behind the scenes that, like, the Beater's bats, in particular, actually carry their own enchantments that, like, kind of, like, help them maintain durability whilst otherwise smacking cannonballs,
right,
you know, through the air. I do wonder, I mean, like, if you were to take a cannonball to the head or a bludger to the head, like, I mean, it seems like that would basically take you out.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like it could kill you.
It does seem like that. It feels like for what is effectively high school, they should have some sort of, like, cushioning charm on the bludger. Like, yeah, it'll knock you around, but, like, this isn't the pros.
But, I mean, that's like, my curiosity is basically, like, you know, it's... Like, I almost wonder at all, like, with bludgers, if, like, they are meant to be disruptors, and, like, while it's very easy to imagine how they could be incredibly dangerous, like, I almost wonder if, like, they more, like... like can speed along, and like once they like come in contact with you, it's more like shoving you than like just hitting you via cannonball velocity, like of some kind.
Right.
Which I mean is never explicitly stated, and you know, it seems like we have plenty of instances where where a bludger does hit somebody and causes rather significant damage. But like that's like one of those things where it's like I can't tell if there's like a chance that like wizards are just like more durable.
I don't feel like they're more durable as they are just like more repairable. You
maybe
know?
That's
like,
it. Yeah,
you break your arm and doesn't matter because I just wave my wand in your back. Like, yeah, it hurt, but like you're good.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that sort of like tracks a little bit. We were talking a little bit about like wizard money and how like it seems like maybe coveting gold is like not as common within the wizarding world because you can solve a lot of your issues with magic
right
anyway.
Yeah,
so it seems like, you know, just hearkening in on your like your skill as a wizard is probably just as useful as having like a vast stores of wealth,
right?
You know, so it's like maybe it's the same thing where it's just sort of like, it's like, yeah, you know, like injuries, we don't really mind that injuries can happen because we can just fix them,
right?
Not that big of like if you
yeah these aren't like cursed injuries, these are like muggle injuries you're enduring.
Right. Yeah, yeah, so you broke your arm, it's like no big deal,
right?
Just a flick of the wand. We'll
flick
be solved.
Of the wand.
Anyway, do you have a review for us to close out today's episode?
I sure do, Ben. This is from Theory List. It says, okay, so first of all, I love everything you do. Y'all are awesome. You help me calm down and laugh all the time. Anyway, so my theory is that Harry is a seer. In Chapter 7 of Philosopher's Stone, he has the dream about the turban talking to him, and along with all of his other dreams of things happening, like when Nagini attacks Mr. Weasley or when Frank the Gardener gets killed, I think it's possible. Anyway, love your shows. What do you think? Is Harry a seer?
Oh man, I mean, I there's no doubt about it that Harry's dreams are extremely telling. But the big thing that I think you have to like keep in mind, at least, is just simply the fact that Harry has like a connection to Voldemort's mind, and I feel like when Voldemort is rising in power, like I feel like almost what you're seeing with like the turban dream is like that's a very mist like form version of Voldemort. So like maybe it is a bit more abstract in terms of like how Harry entering into Voldemort's mind looks, you know, because there's less of a mind to enter. It's more like a blurred concept of like thoughts and elements. Whereas like when he's like witnessing like what's happening to Frank Bryce, is that the gardener? Yeah. Like literally at this point in time, you've got like rudimentary Voldemort who has this like basic body back. He's still incredibly weak, but like entering into his mind, you know, you might be able to see what's going on. And then as you continue forward and like, you know, like Voldemort discovers that Harry's destroying his Horcruxes, you know, at that stage of the process, Harry's not just like seeing what Voldemort is seeing, but he's feeling what Voldemort is feeling.
Yeah. I mean, Harry eventually gets to the point where he can just like flit into Voldemort's mind, like at will.
Yeah.
But there, and so you're, I mean, Harry certainly has, most of the things he's seeing are in real time, not like the future.
Yes, that's a good point as well. Yeah, right. So he's witnessing like what Voldemort is experiencing somewhere.
Right. So I don't think Harry is a seer because we also never see him see anything in the future that is not related to Voldemort.
Right.
And most of the things to do with Voldemort are in the present, and they are all basically directly connected to the fact that Harry is a Horcrux, and he's typically either seeing, he's seeing through the vantage point of another Horcrux, whether that's Voldemort or another piece of Voldemort's soul, whether that's Voldemort Prime himself or like through Nagini's eyes when she attacks like Mr. Arthur Weasley.
Yeah, that's a good point. And what else I was going to say about this was that basically like Trelawney, we do know eventually is like, I mean, despite the fact that she is teaching the class that should suggest that she should know that she's a seer, it seems like the actual visions she does experience, like the two that like Dumbledore regards as like, wow, I think that what you witnessed was like an actual true blue prophecy. She's not aware of either.
Yeah, she
of
doesn't
them.
Even know that they happened.
Yeah, which is sort of like its own kind of like interesting. So like the fact that to me what that suggests is that like as a seer, if it's a skill, like it probably must be the case that you almost need to become what's the term, some people have talked about this before, like inside of their dreams where they can become like in the driver's seat and they can like fly around, and lucid dreaming is the term for it.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's, people say you can train yourself to have lucid dreams where you can basically like fall asleep and then in the magical world of sleep just do whatever you want. So it almost makes me feel like to be a seer is like in a similar capacity. Like,
yeah,
you almost have to realize you're having these visions and then also be able to like consciously enter the vision so that you can take something from it.
Yeah. But weirdly, the other thing about Trelawney is that like, while she is unaware of the genuine prophecy she has, all of the little predictions she makes along the way are all actually true.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Annoying because she's like such a fraud, but like she's still always right.
I know. Yeah. It'll be a lot of fun when we get to Prisoner of Azkaban and we can take all of like her little like one aside comments and be like, this actually happens. Yeah. Like she's not like she is making it up, but somehow also it does come to pass.
Right. Yeah. Or some of the time she's not, like when she's like, yeah, Neville's going to break the cups. And it's like, sure enough, Neville broke the cups. And it's like, did you just recognize that Neville's really clumsy, or did you just genuinely prophesize that?
Right, that's the question. Yeah. No, it's very interesting. So anyway, I'm looking forward to for book three when we can really like just completely peel apart every layer of what Trelawney has to say.
Well, man, we're getting close to the end of book one here, because that was chapter 11, right?
Yes, we're coming up on chapter 12.
Chapter 12 of 17.
One of my favorite chapters. I'm super excited about this one. This is a super sad one. It is a super sad one. It's going to hit you just square in the feels.
Mm-hmm.
But the Mirror of Erised is always one of those that I've just always thought was just like truly amazing. And I remember as a kid, the discovery that Erised is desire backwards, just thinking like,
if you saw it in a mirror, then it's you reflected. Could read it. Yeah, oh.
Yeah. It's so cool. Anyway, I love the Mirror of Erised as an artifact. It's a fun one. So looking forward to chapter 12. But otherwise, until next time,
we will see you through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.